This is Barry Tyker of the Oral History Project. Today is October 12th, the year 2000. I'm in the Steenbach Library Conference Room with Norm Sunstedt, who was Director of Housing here at the University from 1983 to 98. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
About. And we're going to be talking about his experience at the University at Wisconsin here. But before we do that, let's talk just a little bit about your background, find out a little bit about who you are. Where were you born? Talk just a little bit about your family, about your early schooling, things like that.
I was born just south of International Falls in Minnesota in a little town called Little Fork. My family lived in the area up around Rainy Lake. My father worked for the Soil Conservation Service. And at that time, International Falls didn't have a hospital, and Little Fork did. Little Fork is almost a non-existent town at this point, but that was where I was born. Most of my growing up years were in Fergus Falls, Minnesota, which is northwestern Minnesota, where, again, my father worked for the Soil Conservation Service and my mother worked for the local paper. I went on to school at the community college there, a two-year college, and then went to Moorhead State College, which is right on the Fargo-Moorhead, on the far North Dakota-Minnesota border. Then I went to graduate school at the University of Nebraska and got my master's there, my undergraduate degree.
Before we go too far, let's talk about what your majors were.
My undergraduate degree was in psych with a minor in sociology. My graduate master's degree was in counseling psych or student affairs or whatever variation of that. Then I was working in housing. Because I was an RA at Moorhead, actually the story that's, I think, more interesting is that I was a real hellion as a kid. Don't think I ever opened a book all the way through high school. Dropped out of community college and was a truck driver. But this pesky war in Vietnam kept calling me. And so I had four different draft physicals, got that close to winding up having to go into the Army, and escaped it by going back to school. And it's a negative sort of thing, but I knew I didn't want to be in the military and I didn't want to go to Vietnam, and that motivated me to be a student that could continue on in school. And I was never one who could work at going to school to hit a C. I was either studying all the time or not at all. So I graduated, I basically dropped out of college, was a truck driver, and then when I went back, graduated with honors. And through that time, because I studied all the time at Moorhead and I lived in the residence halls, although at the time I was 21 and a junior, they said, my RA on the floor said, you know, you're here all the time. You're the one who wants it quiet. You're the one who's maintaining order here. Why don't you be an RA next year? And I hadn't given it any thought. At the time, the processes were quite lenient. And so I saw someone like a dean of students or something, and they hired me. And I was an RA, and
RA stands for
Resident Advisor.
Okay.
And this was at Moorhead State. And that experience of living in residence halls had a phenomenal effect on me. And it wasn't that there was any programming or any deep philosophy of student development, any of that. It was that coming out of a small town in rural Minnesota, I had a pretty narrow breadth of experience with other people. And I met people who were gay, who were Jewish, who were from Africa, even in the small school of Moorhead State. And that was fascinating to me. I had been narrow. I strived to be in a clique. I had a real narrow definition of myself and the world. And this experience in the halls at Moorhead really changed me to say, isn't it fascinating how people can be so different, have such good logic to their belief system, be it no religion, Lutheranism, or some other religion. And I just thrived on that and felt that knowing more about the world was exposing yourself to things that are different than what you were raised with. That's enriching, that's wonderful, and you get that more in residence halls than you get anywhere else. At least that was my experience. And so I loved that experience. When I graduated, however, my intention was to do something like being a high school counselor or something like that. But there was the Army again waiting for me.
The long arm of Uncle Sam.
And I didn't have any self-confidence back then. And one of my instructors, all of my classes had, in my junior senior year, were 12 students or less.
Wow.
They were all at seminar tables. They were all taught by PhDs or someone who was just finishing their work. A small school was a great place for me, and all of the classes were discussion classes. So we got to know each other very well, and one of my faculty advisors, mentors, said, what are you going to do? And I said, I don't know. I'm getting close to getting drafted. He said, well, why don't you go to graduate school, which had never crossed my mind. And I said, I don't have any money, and I don't have any particular plan. He said, well, you work in housing, don't you? He said, and he had graduated with his EDD from the University of Nebraska. And he said, I know the assistant dean of students there. Let me give him a call, and blah, blah, blah. I wound up, this is the real funny story on this, I wound up at the University of Nebraska, and when I arrived, they were quite shocked. The reason they were so shocked is, although my name was Scandinavian, they thought I was black. And the reason they thought I was going to be black is this advisor, faculty member, mentor of mine was black. Mm. And back then, a black person in Moorhead, Minnesota, or the University of Nebraska was really rare.
Yeah, right.
He was an athlete. Well, I then worked in housing, and I wasn't impressed with the graduate program in ed psych at Nebraska, and was fulfilled by my work in housing.
What did you do in housing?
I was a graduate assistant, which was sort of a glorified resident advisor in a large building, a 1,100 student building. And I enjoyed that in the same way I'd enjoyed the experience at Moorhead. I don't think I was terribly valuable, but talking to students who were troubled, trying to get programs that had students get in contact with one another, learning new things, learning about people who are different than themselves and all that sort of thing. At the end of the first year, during the first year, they were building three new buildings. And this was, what is this, about 67, 66, 67. They were, throughout the United States, the boomers were going to college. And there was a huge demand for space in colleges, both in residence halls and classrooms and so on. They were building these buildings, and they couldn't hire people fast enough to run them. And so they made an exception and hired me to run one of these brand new buildings. I didn't have my master's, which was one of their requirements, but they came up with a plan by which I had to complete my master's in that 1 year. I stayed in the summer, got extra credits done, and got my master's done, I think, in that first year, and opened a brand new building, which was a lot of fun. In the housing racket, what you'd really appreciate about that kind of circumstance is it's the one time in a building that at the end of the year when the student says, oh, that damage in this room, I didn't create, it was there before. That cannot be said. So so I got into it that way. It was a real unique circumstance in that the demand was so great that they were providing opportunities for people like myself that had, say, less of a formal background at the time than they were normally requiring. And then I think, honestly, I worked hard and did well. Sort of having the opportunity lets you, if you have done a good job, succeed and move ahead of what normally might occur. Had I not done well, I suspect I'd have been flushed out too. And so I did that for a couple of years, and at that time had completed my master's, and more importantly, I'd turned 26. I was pre-lottery, and at 26 you became something other than whatever the highest draft status was. And so I was no longer eligible to be drafted, and I interviewed for a job and got a job at the University of Michigan in an experimental college.
Before we get to Michigan, when were you thinking at Nebraska? When did you start to decide that housing might be the kind of area you might want to investigate more thoroughly?
Probably in about 67, when I started running a building myself. I felt good about it. I found in this counseling student affairs program, I had, of course, that academic experience, but then I had the experience of real work in housing. And in housing, this is oversimplifying, but there are two things. one part of that job is administration.
Mm-hmm.
And what I say about that is the goal in housing is to try to treat large numbers of people in an efficient way, but in a way that makes them feel as though they're being treated mm-hmm. individually. Mm-hmm. The other part of that job is the counseling part of it, the one-to-one, the troubled individual, a counseling kind mm-hmm. of circumstance. And I found that what was most natural for me, that I think I had the best instincts for, were the administrative things. And that just came from the work.
Mm-hmm.
Probably I saw over time what I spent my time on was more administration mm-hmm. than counseling. And so I kind of gravitated toward that. And so somewhere in there, I don't remember a moment, but I made a decision.
Did that surprise you? That because you had been in psychology and everything, the more counseling aspect, and mm-hmm. you find that you have your proclivity is more toward the administrative end of it.
Yeah, I don't know if I ever thought about it, Barry. I knew it came to be. I think sometimes life is you define yourself after you wind up doing it, then you consciously move toward it. I think it was just sort of a natural evolution, and I have great respect for people who do the counseling
mm-hmm,
side of
right.
it. Just it wasn't my bent, I guess. Before we go on to the Michigan stuff, were there other things about pre?
No, I just want to
okay.
get a sense of where you were.
Yeah.
How did you find out about the Michigan job?
If these stories get too long, cut me off, but I knew it was time to look for a permanent job, and so that was an advancement. I was quite self-assured at this point and knew I should be running the universe,
mm-hmm.
and the opportunities at Nebraska weren't, there wasn't something there for me at that time, and so I thought we'd look at the market. There's a national conference that occurs, rotates around the country, and this particular year in 69 was in Las Vegas, Nevada. A fellow from Texas that I worked with and another fellow who was in a doctorate program, the three of us drove 24 hours straight through from Lincoln, Nebraska to Las Vegas in February, I think it was.
Oh my.
And the guy who owned the car, who we were teamed up driving, this is another interesting story, is a black man, and when we went through Wyoming, we had some experiences just buying gas or stopping for food that I was amazed at how people looked at him, and there was a sense of hate in their eyes, and what were a couple of white guys doing with this black guy, and all that, and there were phenomenal learning experiences
mm-hmm,
at that
mm-hmm.
age. We got to Las Vegas. Those two guys weren't looking for jobs. I was. I had gone to Penny's in Lincoln and gotten myself a suit. I still remember it. It's a kind of a plaid. I don't still own it, but I still remember it. Oh, it was an ugly green suit. But I'd slap that on every morning and I'd go off to interviews. And these were, this still exists. This is the meat market for mm-hmm. that kind of business. They would sleep till noon or so, and then they'd went to the bars, partied, all the shows at night. I'd drag in from being upbeat, positive, and giving people my spiel all day long, and I'd be ready for bed, and they'd show up hours later. So we were on a different cycle. But I interviewed for 3 days, probably 20-minute interviews, every half an hour, a different one. And at the end of all of that, I got two calls. One was from Brookings, South Dakota, and I don't remember what happened with that one. And another one was from the University of Michigan Housing Office. And frankly, at that moment and today, I have no recollection of ever interviewing with them.
Mm.
So they invited me out for an interview. And why, I don't know. But of course, it was quite a compliment because the University of Michigan was thought of very highly.
Yeah, right.
And I interviewed there, interviewed for a couple different jobs in housing. This is still this time in which there's a shortage of
mm-hmm.
housing professionals.
Mm-hmm.
And I had the credentials, you know, as did a lot of other people. And it turned out, I discovered later, that actually there were two jobs, two different housing facilities that they were considering me for. One of them was a large building that was run in a traditional way by the housing office. The other was the experimental college, the residential college. And that the residential college had been an issue. It was 2 years old, and it had been a kind of one of these things that, when you think about it, can naturally happen. The college proper was run by the College of Literature, Science, and the Arts, mm-hmm. and had its own little administration. And then the housing part of it was run by housing.
Oh, okay.
And the guy they had that was the housing guy, as makes some sense, was terribly loyal to traditional housing values, mm-hmm. rules, and regulations. There were always fights between these. They were two hierarchies with different goals, different mm-hmm. ends in mind, and they'd conflict. And this wasn't working well for them, for the college. And so they were looking for someone who could be more open-minded, mm-hmm. I think, could mm-hmm. kind of mm-hmm. see the good and the mm-hmm. and the issues with each group and bring them together. And whatever it was in me, some of it was me being terribly naive, I think. Both the housing office and the residential college decided that I was the candidate they wanted. I had the choice of going to this other building, but I did like the idea mm-hmm. of this college. Mm-hmm. It was intriguing. It was a building, an old quadrangle, a little bit like Cronsage, but mm-hmm. a little more altogether. It was remodeled. It had held 11 or so hundred students, was remodeled down to 800 students, had a faculty offices, classrooms, library, art studios, and resident rooms, dining rooms, and all that in that one building. Old 30s, 40s building, red brick, beautiful place. And so they agreed, I got hired, and I came there, and this was in the fall of 69.
Yeah, this is when it was all starting.
When I arrived...
You had your Vietnam, in a sense, after all.
Yes, and I was terribly naive. One of the guys at the residential college said, I was terribly Lincoln-esque, which was, of course, from Lincoln, Nebraska, but I was out of the plains. I don't think, ever seen a woman without a bra on. Michigan is more of a... the student body comes from the suburbs of Chicago, New York, Washington, D.C. It's a very urban mm-hmm, place. Mm-hmm. Lincoln was not.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. And I was from the plains or the northern part of Minnesota, so it was quite a shock, very fascinating. And people were very much more confrontive. There was more diversity. Fascinating. I enjoyed it, loved it. And it turned out that it was a good place for me to be. It was not, and it never would be, the kind of place that would reflect the way I was brought up. Very different. And if I would say, where in my life have I been most comfortable, it probably was coming back to Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. Because I consider Wisconsin and Minnesota culturally to be quite a bit the same. Mm-hmm. And Michigan was very different for me, so I was always kind of adjusting to it. But I was there for nearly 15 years and did enjoy it. The college, however, I think we did reach the point at which there weren't these fights between the two administrations. Mm-hmm. The director of housing there was very sympathetic to trying to get this college going. It was the bureaucracy around a big entity or an organization like housing and the bureaucracy in the college that conflicted, and the director of housing wanted to see this succeed. The director of the college wanted to see this succeed. When we developed personal relationships, me to both of them, we got beyond that. And within a year, I think things were going pretty well, and I think they still are. It had to be kind of a different entity. It couldn't be just the residential college being a part of LNS and being strictly an academic program. They had to appreciate the bureaucracy of housing all mm-hmm, these students.
Mm-hmm. So it's a balancing act.
Yeah, and I used to describe that my job was, at least initially, to be the P between two symbols.
Yes, yeah.
But
did the P ever get kind of whacked?
Really, I didn't have much trouble. It wasn't any great wisdom on my part. I think it was maybe that I hear other people's points of view and listen to them. I didn't have ultimate power, of course. There was the dean of the college and there was the director of housing. And I just had to accommodate between them, listen, suggest. And in all of that, somehow or another, it worked. I think probably another thing that happened was that both sides knew the fighting from the first 2 years was not mm-hmm. productive.
Right, right.
And so I may have been fortunate to be there at the right time.
Yeah, yeah.
And
that helps.
It does, yeah, being in the right place at the right time. And so I did that for 4 years. And it was a good experience. But going back to arriving, I arrived in the summer. I started, I think, July 1st, something like that.
And what year was this?
69. And the windows were all busted out around the door, and there was this strong smell of tear gas in the building. The mail in my office hadn't been opened, the campus mail, for something like 2 or 3 months.
Oh, my goodness.
The guy who had been in my position before me left the university, and I don't think he was pleased with anything that was going on mm-hmm. at the time. So my first exposure was that this building was, I think in Wisconsin's parallel, the Union was the safe place for the radicals here, mm-hmm. the safe place where SDS, all of the kind of the most radical students.
Michigan had them too.
Yes.
Indeed.
Was in this building, the residential college. Yeah. And
why was that?
Well, this college was where the most liberal, reactionary kind of students at the university were from.
Okay.
There was a representative government. They shut the college down a few times even during my time there on various issues. And they were usually issues related to the war, race, the issues of the day.
Yeah, right, right.
And it was a good thing that I was single, and it was a good thing that I loved the work, and that I didn't have a separation in mind between personal life and work, because it was a job that went day and night, but it was exciting.
Yeah.
And here I was at the time, 26, 27, 28. It was really exciting, and it was a lot of fun. It was, the goal was to try to have these community forums, and I think they were every week, in which everyone could express their points of view. The bent or bias in the place was that the point of view that was held to be most right was always the left point of view, mm-hmm. and those conservative students that were there, and there were some, had a hard time being heard. But there were enough of them, and they were outspoken enough to where there was always a good interplay, and these were fascinating meetings. They'd last 3, 4, 5, 6 hours.
I was going to say, any all-nighters?
They were late.
Yeah.
And but they were fun, and the dean of the college was really good about hearing these things. And he was an older gentleman, English professor, Jim Robertson, and his son is a geologist here in Wisconsin mm-hmm. somewhere. Very, very good guy, very gentle, and there were a couple of assistant deans, one of them being Ted Newcomb, one of the fathers of social psychology, mm-hmm. and he actually was the founder in terms of the idea of the experimental college, the residential college. And I'm sure had read materials from the experimental colleges in the 30s, mm-hmm. like the Micklejohn thing and so on.
Right.
But it was a lot of fun, very exciting. It was very trying. These were students, many, many of these students were terribly spoiled. They were also, many of them were in the drug culture.
Mm-hmm.
And they were from broken homes. They were... one of the things that I think was wrong with the college, although it was they selected randomly from students who had been accepted to the Literature and Science College of the University of Michigan, they selected randomly from those who self-selected to want to be in this college. And the kind of student who'd go to this college, there were no grades given. They wrote paragraph descriptions about how they'd done. They tended to be students who were more inclined to take risks, not worry about their future. Most of it, in my sense, was because they were so well off, they were going to be fine anyway. But they were challenging. I had trouble, for example, when I got there, they allowed dogs in the room. So we had dog manure
goodness.
All over the place.
Goodness.
St. Bernard's. and they'd get stoned on drugs. They'd drink in the buildings, make sangria, which was just a composite of every kind of booze they could put together. They were a wild group, and of course everything was, why can't I do that?
Mm-hmm.
And working through that, in that era it wasn't because I told you so or no, you can't do that. You had to work through a process, and that was good training.
Yeah.
I believe in that anyway, in terms of coming to a decision, is including people, and and listening to them, but it was trying, and it was a good experience for me because I would expect that my upbringing was more this is right, this is wrong. Being a rebellious kid when I was growing up, I think helped me be more appreciative of being questioned, mm-hmm. or authority being questioned, because I felt that way myself, wanting that kind of expression or freedom. I did love it. I think it was a great job. It was a great time to have that job. Toward the time I left it in 73, it was becoming less interesting, yeah, because it was becoming institutionalized.
Yeah,
and, it,
yeah,
and housing was is very different there than here. I was always an active participant with the other building directors, whatever we were called, at Michigan. So I attended all of the meetings with housing people, and then I attended the meetings with mm-hmm. the residential college people. So I was a part of housing all along, mm-hmm. and had their respect, and respected those people in the other buildings. Mm-hmm. The housing division there was more, I'd say this about probably the university as well. The bent at the University of Michigan is, if somebody comes up with a new idea, often the reaction is, I don't have any idea if it'll work or not, why don't we try it? The bent in the institution, I'm taking extremes here, at the University of Wisconsin or the other Scandinavian states, I would say, would be, well, let's see, let's think of all of the things that would be good about that and all of the things that might be bad about that, and we'll spend a lot of time on this, and we'll make a decision to change something based on an awful lot of dialogue and a lot of thought, and sort of suspicious of change and less inclined to make it. Michigan's was more the hell with it, let's give it a try. If it doesn't work, it'll fail, and then we'll go back.
Yeah.
And those are really
was quite, that kind of an institutionalized thing? Was that something that you had learned had been
no, it
in
was
force,
a,
or was it something that was just more active when you were there because of the people?
I think it was. I think it's an institutional bent. I think it is the style more in Michigan, and of course the style more here. Of course, I can't be sure because I've been gone from there for quite a long time. But I visit back there. My in-laws live by Ann Arbor, and so we get back there. And I think it's still more that way. Also, you know, the difference in Michigan is it's, as people will say, the largest private university in the world. It's money is no object.
Yeah, right.
And so when you have no end of resources, you can take more risks, they did. And just the view of money is to not be frugal and necessarily cost efficient every step of the way. The goal is to try and experiment with new things to see how they work, and maybe you push back the frontiers of knowledge and do something
sometimes
new.
Sometimes that costs money, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Wisconsin's a little slower to do that.
Now, one of the people you had, I interviewed last year, was Robin Fleming.
Uh-huh.
He was the president of the University of Michigan. Did you have any association with him in housing?
Just, I probably met him once or twice, and I think after he retired in the grocery store. Mm-hmm. He was involved with one incident after I'd been there in which they'd thrown some students in jail for some kind of sit-in or something. Mm-hmm. And because his background was mediation and all, I think he handled it pretty well. I think he did well at Michigan during that time because he had been used to working with disagreeing sides mm-hmm. in labor negotiations and so on. He was very highly respected, and of course they named the administration building there at Michigan after him, and did that while he's still alive, which is
amazing.
Real rare. But I didn't have a lot of dealings with him. I was a underling way down there. But I don't know of people who say bad things mm-hmm. about him in terms of that era.
Well, after interviewing him, I could sort of understand why he is. One of the stories he told me is when you, in his young days as a labor negotiator, when you're up there with all these Teamsters and you've got these Irish guys shouting in your face at the top of their lungs and everything, he said, you get a couple students yelling at you, so what?
Yeah.
You can handle that pretty well.
Yeah. No, I think he was probably pretty good. And it was a hard time for a lot
was.
Of people.
It was a hard time
I think
for colleges.
Hard times for probably the higher bureaucrats, and for people like me, it was just a hell of a lot of fun. You know, it was a lot of hours.
Right person at the right time.
Yeah, it was. And I met my wife. She was a home economist in terms of teaching and hated it. Mm. She'd just been out of school, quit that, and was working in food service, just managing food service in the building I worked in. And we got to dating, and we went to some of these weird plays that students would put on in the theater. And I remember the one I remember distinctly us going to in this small little theater I took her to, the focus of the play in some way that had been written by one of the students, who is probably now a famous playwright or something, was on the storyline related to, and the name and the use of the term over and over again was tight asshole. But it kind of reflected the time, you know, where the young people were critical of the inflexibility of the administration, of the world
order. Cool, yeah.
And I'm sure all of that experience made me far more.
Okay.
At any rate, that was a good experience. And should we be moving on?
No, I was just going to say, now, you then moved on, you worked in Michigan for another, what, 5 or 6 years?
About 8 years, I think. I was 4 years at the residential college. Then I went, I was a sort of a middle management type at, I ran an area, there were 3 geographical areas of housing at the university. And I was promoted to being an area coordinator, and it was a great job in that it had me responsible for the area that the residential college was in, which I think made them feel good that I wasn't going to be entirely gone. I was in charge of the residence life program, food service, custodial maintenance, and the budget operations. Mm-hmm. And it was a great experience in that you learned all of the aspects of housing that were important to know if you're going to be a director of housing. So I did that for 4 years, and that I learned more about budgeting, a lot more about budgeting. I learned more about food service and maintenance. In that job, the most challenging thing was we had a strike of the service employees, custodial, maintenance, and food service employees of the whole university. And the goal at the college or the university was to stay open. And we fed 9,000 students, maintained housing, clean bathrooms for 22 days with management staff in a labor state, which is a tough
Michigan
deal. And I loved the experience. It was really trying and very difficult, and I was just shot when it was over. I was also on the bargaining team for the university, which was fascinating. So I'd sit in these smoke-filled rooms and listen to their harangue all day long, and then I'd go and clean pots and pans. And then, of course, there were times when, large times, when there were no negotiations because there was a loggerhead. And then I worked all the time. And the fun part of it was, in a game sense, to try to outthink and strategize in a way to beat the other side. Mm-hmm. One of them was delivering food. They were always thinking if they could stop delivery, and they were right, we'd be stopped dead in terms of feeding. And if you couldn't feed and house the students, you're going to have to close the university. Mm-hmm. That was the key to it. And so, and there were good people other than me who were working on this. One of them was that they were intercepting our phone communications with the food trucks. And they were having some success with that, of course, for one day. The next day is, we know we can send them wherever we want to.
Oh, but misdirection there. Yeah.
Oh, it got tough, and the toughest part of that was there were a number of supervisors in housing who were raised in this labor environment, and their parents were assembly line workers in the auto plants, and the idea of working and crossing picket lines was very tough for them, and so we had to send some people home who wouldn't perform, and I understand and sympathize with that more now than I did then. It was a tough deal, and it's hard on people, and it has a tremendous impact later on, and so strikes are very serious things. As an experience in life, it was a fascinating one. It was getting out of the drudgery administration and living day to day in a ever-changing environment, and I enjoyed that. In fact, a friend of mine I worked with and I said, you know, the next time they do this, we're going to hire out to the other side. It's just kind of fun to play it. And so I did that for 4 years and then was made associate director of housing. All of the time I was at Michigan, I reported to the same guy. who was an associate director of housing, who eventually wound up being the director of housing, and then hired me to be the guy who was in charge of the operation side of housing.
And that person was?
Bob Hughes is his name. The original guy that hired me was John Feldkamp, and then the associate was Bob Hughes. He needed to have some people who knew the field. And by the time, this is one thing I didn't have at Wisconsin, and I've always regretted it, but you can only have it, I think, once in life. Over the years I was at Michigan, I worked in every building, I believe. I knew every corner, every janitor closet, every peculiarity of every building, and this was a big operation. It's bigger than Wisconsin's. And so in working through a strike, in working as a grunt, all of those things, mm-hmm. I had the respect of people throughout that this guy knows housing. Mm-hmm. The central housing office was far more distant psychologically than is the case at Wisconsin, I think, but that can be an issue anywhere. And so the guy as director needed somebody who knew the pulse of the staff and operations out in the field, and I was that guy. I'd been there, and I knew the place well, and that was a lot of fun. That was losing that by coming to another place, coming in as a director, that's too bad. And that's one of the things that Newell had going for him here, Newell Smith, and Paul Evans has again, because both of them were kind of raised in the system. And that's a great thing to have. I'm not saying you should always hire internally, but I think it's a wonderful...
Well, it's a time saver, certainly.
Time saver.
You know the place and you know the people.
And now, if they're good people, they can really use that. I mean, if you had worked up from the ground up and been lousy and hated by all those people from your experience, be hell. But with Newell and now with Paul, that's not the case. They're very highly thought of, and so that's good.
So when did you start looking toward Wisconsin? When did you decide to become a director?
The first contact with Wisconsin was when I was going to Michigan. My family lived in Minnesota. I had gone back up there, and everything I owned was on top of my two-door Buick, and I was driving to Ann Arbor. And as I drove through Wisconsin, and I think that was the first time I ever had, I was struck by the beauty of the area and the lakes and all of that. And I said to myself, oh, I'd like to work here someday. Mm. And it's fascinating that I remember that. Mm. And went on to Michigan, worked there, and of course, on occasion, would be at all of the Big Ten schools at mm-hmm. the meetings. But I didn't have any particular thought about the place. And I knew that at some point I was going to have to leave Michigan because the guy I worked for, Bob Hughes, was, as we said, wore amazing blue underwear. He was never going to leave.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And he's young, comparatively young, and had his style, his plan, and there wasn't going to be an opportunity for mm-hmm. me. Mm-hmm. So I knew at some point, if I wanted to be a director, I was going to have to move. There were very few mm-hmm. jobs I would move for because we had designed and built our own house, mm-hmm. my wife mm-hmm. and I, and we loved the place we were on. We lived on the Huron River, and it was a gorgeous place. But the job came along, and I don't know if I can remember all of this, but my first reaction is, of course, I wouldn't have a chance for this. Again, I was associate director of housing. I'd been it for, I think, 4 years. Michigan.
You were still young, too.
Yeah, I was 39 or 40. Michigan paid well. But I know in my innards, I needed to do something my own program. And the ideal for me would have been had the director been leaving, but he wasn't mm-hmm. going to. And philosophically, we differed a lot. And as I worked with him more and more, I didn't enjoy it.
What were your basic differences with him?
Well, one of them is a characteristic that I still hold, and he was probably more in line with Michigan than me. He was an elitist, and I'm a populist. Mm. And I can, I suppose, be biased and too cruel here, but... sought personal gain, loved power, loved to spend money, and we just had very different values. And so I needed to leave.
Yeah, right.
And so this came along. I didn't think I had a chance at it. And Ray Wersminski, who also in the housing here I'd worked with over the years because we'd attend Big Ten meetings.
He was business manager.
Yeah, Ray, one time or another, I don't remember how we got to talking about it, and he said, are you going to apply? And I said, gee, I don't know, I thought you would be applying. Oh, no, he said, I'm on the search and screen committee. Well, it tells you I didn't know much about the place. I'd only met Newell once. Newell Smith, the previous director, from the outside of Wisconsin, being the professional that he is, and his persona was such that you thought of him, at least I did, as very serious, somber, hard, and I think we interpreted Wisconsin through what we'd see in mm-hmm. that persona, and it wasn't light. Wasn't
the
sure
old sergeant.
Yeah, it was. It was probably that true. It was a military background. And, well, at any rate, I didn't think there was much chance at it. But for some reason or another, at some point I decided to apply and did. Mm-hmm. And I came back for two interviews, I think, two or three. Mm-hmm. Len Van Ness was over that area. And I think in your notes you'd asked something about who the other candidates. And I remember Bill Paleen is one of them. Bill had been area coordinator here and was the director of housing at Cornell. Mm-hmm. And I knew Bill. All of us in senior housing jobs in the Big Ten, all of us knew each other, or even beyond the Big Ten. And so I knew Bill, and I thought for sure Bill would get the job. As I reflect back on it, I think, you know, every time a selection occurs, there's a bent, bias, whatever, on the part of an administration or a committee or both. And in this case, Bill had a, it's my sense of knowing Bill, that his strong points, his bent was on the education side of it, of housing, the student development, counseling, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. And I didn't lack for that, but the last job I had at Michigan was really the operation mm-hmm. side. Mm-hmm. And because housing was under Len Van Ness, and I think the philosophy of Irv Shane and all of that, they were very concerned that a big housing operation like this, one, Wisconsin runs their big programs in an autonomous sort of way. As I used to say about it, when you get hired to run a big division at Wisconsin, they expect you're the expert and that they aren't. And the third decision is to hire you or get rid of you if you're not doing the job, but not to micromanage you. Mm-hmm. But they're concerned that they have somebody who can do that. So they were looking for somebody they saw who could mind the bucks, mind the physical plant. And when you think about it, Newell was sort of that style too. I think what I was fortunate to have there was more experience and credibility in terms of the operation side of things. If at some point, say, Wisconsin had the housing division report to student affairs, Paul Ginsberg, dean of students at the time, Bill Paleen would probably be the director, or been the director, and I wouldn't have been. So, and there's nothing right or wrong about that. It's just the way things work at the time. Yeah, and I'm sure I knew the other candidates. Well, two of them were internal. Bill Sweet, who was mm-hmm. internal in charge of student affairs and housing here, who has since passed away, and Bob Fessenden. Mm-hmm. And Bob is still on the staff and a great asset to Wisconsin's housing operation. I think those were the final four. It's a little vague to me now, but a good pool. And a story about that I want to tell you, if we have time,
sure.
was we came out here. We had built this house. My wife and I worked nights and weekends for 3 years. It was the dream house. And as we were shingling it, we picked out where our cemetery plots would go. This was the house. 2 years later, here's this thing where we're going to move from this place. And so we drove out here, and it was in, I think it was the basketball season time or whatever, you know, we stayed at the Friedrich Center. And you had your annual blizzard mm-hmm. right where we're here. We're driving around town. You can't see a damn thing for the snow. It's the ritual. You think you should be doing it and familiarizing yourself. But we stopped, as someone had suggested, to what is now this little brewery down off the Capitol. And I can't remember the name of it was the hotel or something. It was a little place where we had a wonderful breakfast.
Oh, it was the Old Fess Hotel.
The Old Fess Hotel. Come back out. And I'd left the lights on the car because of all of this blizzardy weather. and the battery's dead. Go back into the Fest Hotel, and I said, can I use the phone, and I'm going to call and get somebody to come out and jump the thing. A waitress, who isn't even our waitress, overhears this, and she says, I've got jumper cables in my car. My car's in the structure over here. Why don't you take it and start your car? Go over there and get her car. And it is a beat-up wreck, and she needs jumper cables because this thing is probably needing jumped quite often. Go out, jump the car, get started, put it back. And we were so impressed with that kind of thing. Never seen her since, whatever. But it was one of those things that made you think, this is a nice place. This
Welcome
is a
to Wisconsin.
Gentle
yeah,
place. Right. And Lannon and his wife took us out. And we had a good experience, but just seeing the place was a joke. We didn't. We moved here. We moved here in the summer. We looked at a house out toward Mazamani, gorgeous house, and we were convinced it's far too far to drive. And so we didn't buy it. We moved into a rental house. We had one dog and two cats, and finding a rental house that mm-hmm. is worth a damn with that kind of situation is good. We lived there for 4 months, bought that house that we originally looked at, moved in and lived there for 14 and a half years.
Oh my goodness.
And by the time we left, 2.5 years ago or so, that distance is not a great distance to Madison anymore. People love to live out there and are tickled that it would be that close to town versus living another 10 miles out. And it was a wonderful place, and actually last night we had dinner with our friends from out there and the people who bought our house. They work at the university now. But we moved here in the summer then of 83, and that was the start of my time here. And I don't know what you want to get.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Neil Smith and you, the contrast in the two people. Now you're coming out, you're taking over for someone who's been at Wisconsin a long time, who has his own management style. You're sort of the new kid on the block. Were you surprised that they hired external on this?
Somewhat.
Yeah.
Somewhat.
Because if you look at the history of housing here, it's been a pretty much of a internal type of an operation.
Yeah, it had been, and I suppose so. You never know when you're coming from anywhere what the biases are. And I was struck by a number of things. Of course, one of them was when I interviewed here, the chancellor interviewed me, Herb Shane.
Oh, he did. Oh, tell me about that.
Well, I remember interviewing in his office, and that was a brief thing, and probably more a courtesy call than anything else. And Len wasn't one to go on at great length in an interview either. But Roger Howard was the chair, and incidentally, I'd suggested you might talk with Roger as an outsider to housing. Roger worked in housing before he was in the dean's office, has been here through three administrations, so he's one with a good perspective. But number of people on the committee that continued, I don't know if I can remember them all now. At any rate, I was taken to dinner, I think at the University Club, by Len and Irv Shane, and they picked me up. This again was a blustery winter, probably February, and Irv is driving a blue American Motors Matador or something, a nothing car. Mm-hmm. At the same time, at the University of Michigan, the president is riding in a chauffeur-driven Buick. So these are dramatic.
Well, this is very interesting.
These are dramatic.
It's a world of symbols, and those are two real symbols right there.
And the president at Michigan at the time is Harold Shapiro, mm-hmm. who, on my hand, of the five most brilliant people I've ever met, he's one of them. Mm-hmm. We used to describe Harold as many people. You don't always understand the answer, but you understand the question. In Harold Shapiro's case, we usually couldn't even understand the question. He was well beyond us, but he was, I think, as well, a good president, and he was president of the University of Michigan, I think, in his 40s, so he was young and brilliant. At any rate, they picked me up, and Irv is wearing this nondescript, grayish kind of long winter coat with a I think it's like a lamb's wool collar. And he's about as down-home a looking guy as you're ever going to see in your life. In Michigan, everyone wore sort of the uniform. It was always a blue blazer and a maize and blue tie. Mm-hmm.
It was kind of corporate America kind of thing, very different. And this real down-home friendliness, I really appreciated and enjoyed. And of course, Herb was brilliant. And I had never been comfortable with sort of the affect of Michigan and sort of the false pretense and so on. There were brilliant people there and all, but there was a conformity, a style that seemed to me to be kind of contrived. And I loved Wisconsin's Be Who You Are. A presentation to the trustees, Board of Regents at Michigan was as much style as content. And the regents or trustees at Wisconsin, it was content. And people could care less if you were perfectly flowing in your sentences or had some fine.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I loved that. I loved it about Ruben Lorenz. Wonderful people I met in the interviews. I interviewed with Ruben as well, now that I think about it. And he was in system at the time. Coming here, let's see, Irv, the interview, I don't remember anything particular about it. Then, of course, with Newell, the difference between Newell and myself, first of all, was studying him. And what I've learned, put together over the years, was Newell and his administration were people who came of age in World War II and had a management style that came out of that time, and I think was perfectly appropriate and great for Wisconsin at the time. They worked together well. They were committed, bright people. I knew that the goal I had to have and was to try to get in and out of this place and not screw up what Newell had set up and his people, that they had a wonderful standard, the ethics of the place, the way it was run, the efficiencies. You're going to follow somebody that good, you're going to have a real struggle. I have followed people in jobs who weren't worth a damn. That's a whole lot easier.
Right. You don't want to follow Vince Lombardi as a coach.
And Newell was wonderful. Newell was very helpful and yet did not intrude at all. And we have very different styles. He, I think, managed in the right way for his time, and I hope I did for my time. One of the things that I did, I think, quite differently, and I think the important thing about all of this is that you talk to other people, because as we all know, we have an interpretation of how we did things ourselves that may not be the way the rest of the world looked at it. And I'm glad you're talking to other people as well as me about that time. My style was to try to develop a team that included the wisdom of all of those on the team in coming to decisions about how we did things.
Not more of a consensus type thing?
In that direction. And I think when I had problems, it was to go too far in that direction. Mm-hmm. It was one of the things that I knew was that I wasn't going to know every nook and cranny of this place. I was entering a different culture. And you need to manage within the culture you're in. The way you do things at Michigan aren't the way you do things at Wisconsin. The people that I had working with me knew Wisconsin. Larry Halley, who stayed with me for a couple of years, and I always thought he probably did it just to help me. I respect him for it, and he is a wonderful person, a wonderful advice giver. And then I had, over time, actually the transitions were, I think, pretty quick. Bob Fessenden was there, who had not a lot of experience. I'd known Bob when he was at Ohio State, and he had come to Wisconsin, I think, 4 years before I did. Bill Sweet was there at the time, who knew Wisconsin well. But the progression was to come to the management team that I finally wound up with, which was Paul Evans, who was originally in charge of student affairs under my administration and then went to facilities at our mutual agreement. Bob Fessenden was originally in charge of facilities and then moved to food service. Again, we both wanted that to occur. Alice Gustafson, who was in charge of administration, who had originally been in charge of conferences, and they're all still there. Mm-hmm. And then Kay Reuter Crowan, who followed Paul when Paul left student affairs, there was first Bill Sweet, who passed away, then Paul took over student affairs, and then Kay followed Paul. Those four people were my senior advisory group, and they knew Wisconsin well. They had different points of view on things, but because they knew more of the grassroots of the operation, they could come to our staff meetings with a perspective that represented their area. And the goal I had was to try to reach a consensus when we could, but knowing that you can't always do that, hopefully we'd come as close to it or the best idea would well up. Mm-hmm. And even if we didn't all agree, that then that would be the way we'd go. That was a different style. Newell, I sat in some meetings before Newell left, and Newell really is a brilliant guy, and he also knew the place from the ground up, and he would listen, but he didn't go on as long as I might to get a consensus or to get an agreement, and he would make his decision, and they'd all march to it.
So it was a unilateral type thing. Mm-hmm. You said this isn't the way it's going to be.
And that's the way all the administration in housing worked anyway, I think. I know there was some concern with that in student affairs, and that makes sense because student affairs people have always been sort of more, thinking it through, and I don't think Newell at that time anyway was as philosophic. He had kind of decided what was his philosophy and how he would operate. And I think he was right for his time, but I think that administrative style, when you even look around the university, is less the case than it was with all of the other people who ran other divisions of the university with the World War II style of things.
It's different generations, mm-hmm. different ideas.
And it should change now that I've gone to some other style. I don't know quite what it is, but I suspect at least toward the end of my time, my style might not have been entirely right for the time, and whatever Paul's is going to be, I'm sure he'll come up with the right one or choose from among the right ones. There was one thing that I did learn in all of this, actually, from Shalala, I think, and that is, this is the case for any organization, many of the things that you have to decide in the upper levels of the organization is make a decision that's a hard decision. The easy ones, the ones that are clearly we should go this way or that way, were made at another level, mm-hmm. as well they should be. And you shouldn't be making all those decisions for the local levels. They should be made down there, closest to the customer. They understand all the issues and they should relate to it. The ones that are really tough are the ones that are 49% wrong, 51% right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you frankly never know which is the 49 and which is the 51. In truth, there are circumstances you wind up in that you have to make a decision and go a particular way when there isn't a perfect way, there isn't a clear way. And that's the decisions you get involved with at the upper levels of management, at the top of the university or whatever you're in. And what I learned from Shalala, observing her, was what you need to do is you pick whatever you think is the best, and then the whole organization needs to go behind that and make it work. And you can make the 49% one or the 51% one or maybe even the 30% one successful if everyone's behind it. Mm-hmm. If you don't have good momentum behind it, it doesn't matter. If you have the 70% one, it isn't going to work. And watching how she did that and kind of studying that, that came to be a point I was clear on. And when you have a good organization, good team, people working together, you can make a decision work. And if you don't have that team togetherness, it won't work. I didn't have that much to do with her, and I'm sure others have come to that same thought. They probably just didn't come to it at the time that I was observing it. So Shane probably had a good sense of that, and Ward too, I don't know.
Well, we'll talk a little bit about them later on. You came into a housing unit that I said is really steeped in tradition. As a matter of fact, when John Jenkins and I were working on a housing book, we thought we ought to get into housing because these guys seem to live forever.
Yeah.
Don Halverson was still around. Lee Burns was still around. You had that whole crew, George Gerda.
Yeah.
Do you have any comments on the on that group of people and their contributions to housing?
I have great respect for them. And I think, I don't know where some of the values that housing has here started, who created them. But I do know that when I came here, this great pride in what they do, respect for one another, sense of organization, a sense of ethics, doing the right thing, being honest, hardworking, all of those values were in place when I got here. And so I would attribute them to Newell, Larry, George, Ray, all of those people. But I don't know but what they were carrying them forward from Don Halverson or Lee Burns. I don't know that. But I do know that those values were in them. And one of the things that I always resented about Michigan was that when I first started working, I wound up working for some people, with some people who did not have good values and were not healthy in terms of work ethics and so on. And when you're young in work, you start in an organization, you learn a lot about what work is. You define work by the people who are around you, how they direct you, what you see. And coming to Wisconsin was really good for me because it improved my values, improved my work ethic, and I resent that Michigan didn't have a higher standard, at least the people I worked with at that time in housing. I know the people who are in charge there now, and I think they're far better. So I don't want to say that they aren't a good place now. But people who grow up in housing in the Wisconsin system, I think grow up or did at that time with good values. When they go to work somewhere else, they are well prepared in terms of how to behave, how to think things through, how to commit themselves to their work. And so I think that's a great attribute to Wisconsin and probably a credit to Newell and his people, and maybe the people before. One time we tried to have a photo session when all of the directors were alive.
Oh, yes.
We got together Lee Burns, Don Halverson. We were all up north at Trout Lake.
Okay.
Well, we tried to get together this photo op of having, at the time it was the five directors of housing from day one at Wisconsin. Don Halverson, Lee Burns, Newell, Larry Halley, and then Newell again, and then me. And it turned out Lee Burns couldn't make it, and then he passed away within that year, I think. But one of the funny things about that, and actually it's said even today, I don't remember what the circumstance was, but when you bring together all of the directors of housing from the University of Wisconsin, Newell directs them. when you get a group together, Newell is ordering us all around in a good way, in a right way. But Newell is a director.
Sergeant.
At any rate, he was good to follow, had a wonderful circumstance, a wonderful setup. The changes that I made in terms of management style, I hope, worked well with the time. But I think he did a wonderful job during his time. And of course, he was nationally known, nationally recognized, highly thought of.
Figures.
And was called on for consulting work throughout and could have done a lot more of it had he chosen to. The one thing about that administration that time, I was going to get to at some point, that is different than our time, I think, is the way the world worked is families were, the women stayed at home, men went to work. In the time I was in housing, we were moving more toward women in the workforce. And so by the time I'd left, but I think it was earlier on, half of the management staff in housing now and in that time were women. And that wasn't the case in Newell's era. Rita McCutcheon was in charge of food service and a career woman and very knowledgeable and all, but sort of the rare exception.
Dorothy Brewer, I think, was another one.
In personnel, yes. And those were kind of the two kinds of jobs you'd find that women would be in, not in any of the others. Maybe in conferences, but rarely. And student affairs had more women in it, but that was a transition that occurred. And one of the other things about that occurred is people, I think, that managed housing prior to us probably gave more of their total life to their work than could be the case with people with families, young kids and so on. And there's still people in management and higher level management and housing now with relatively young children. So some of the things that people would do that sort of gave to housing or the university all the time, we pulled back a bit on. Winterfest was a big event in housing that
the housing administrative staff put on this great event, and it was largely for retirees and to some degree for current working employees. And people worked themselves to the bone on this thing. We eliminated it, I eliminated it, and it was that our people who were in management really did not have the time, if they were going to be responsible members of their family, to do all of those things. And I think that culturally there were changes anyway, as families had both adults working, no one had the time for all of these events even. So we changed, we tried some other events, picnics, we still have the bowling party, we have a golf outing, we had those kinds of things, but we pulled back from some of that. And I think that's right. I think it's right in terms of the culture. I know some of the retirees kind of didn't like that because they felt it was their
traditions,
due.
Yeah, right.
But you make these decisions and you have to along the way. Anyway, I want to go back to say that the following Newell was great because the place was well set up, but a very high standard to try to deal with. However, that people had this good standard, work ethic and so on, of course, again, made it a wonderful place within which to work. One of the things I would say about that is that people who work in housing at Wisconsin largely come from here. They aren't displaced people from somewhere else. They have the values of the area, and it's good farm values. It's the maintenance people, Newell used to say, and I think it's true, they always tried to hire somebody who had left farming, because they could haywire anything into making it work again.
And they knew how to work.
And being frugal, yeah. Here the goal was to try to keep things working and save money. Michigan, the labor force was largely people who were displaced from the hills of Kentucky and Tennessee who came up to build the war machine. And their values were very different and not as high in terms of things like cleaning standards, maintenance, and so on. So the labor force here was wonderful to work with, and I appreciated that, and I think it's still probably true.
Let me go back one quick question regarding women. Did you make a conscious effort during your administration to hire more women minorities too? Let's put minorities in that.
I don't know how conscious I would say it was. I tried to hire the best people I could find, with a lot of advice from people around me, of course. And it turned out, because I think this is the case, that there are a lot of talented women who had limited opportunities because of the way the world was in terms of, I guess, a prejudice against hiring women. We were lucky to, if you were open-minded, to be able to hire very, very talented people. And I think the goal still was to try to hire the best people possible, but we saw among the people there some very talented women, and they rose to the top and did well. In terms of minorities, Wisconsin's always had a tough time attracting minorities, and we made some real efforts with not much success. We were able to hire some minority staff members along the way, and I'm sure there's some now. But you have to contend with the culture as well, and this is a really white culture. And one successful hire we made, eventually the person left, not because he didn't love housing here, and I think he's sincere about that. It was that it wasn't the culture for him and his family. One of the observations I would make, which is right or wrong, but my belief about Wisconsin, and I would say it's true of Minnesota, the culture, the Northern European culture, is I was raised with this driving urge to be fair. I think it's the value I was raised with in my home, is fairness, treating people equally. And that converts to being said, treating people the same. And that is such a driving philosophy and belief in this culture that it's very hard to have same go on as the highest priority with affirmative. Affirmative is one that tries to provide a little leg up, an opportunity, an exception to say make up for past discrimination, give people a shot. It is in direct conflict with civil service, with if you believe you're being fair and even in terms of treating people, you have a very hard time incorporating into your culture affirmativeness. And I think that has always been a problem here, and I think it always will be, probably.
I appreciate both of those things. I don't
problem want, in a funny kind of way.
Yeah,
I see what you're saying.
I don't, and I think the other thing that a Northern European of Wisconsin or Minnesota would say is, in their hearts, that I have never discriminated consciously against someone else based on their race, religion, sex. I think that's a value of this fair and equal treatment of people that is important in that culture. Feeling that way so strongly, I don't think Wisconsin has ever done very well in trying to figure out how it can be affirmative or admitting that it needs to be.
Interesting.
I think one of the things about that that happens is we here, we in Wisconsin, Minnesota, are very welcoming of any culture into our culture. We're not inclined to expand the peripheries and values of our culture to welcome in different cultures and bringing their values with them. If they would like to be like us, we're fine with that. And I think that's sincere.
Mm-hmm.
But many of these other cultures, of course, have values that are different and want to be accepted on their own footing, not being a part of what are the Northern European values and cultures, cultural mores. So I think we weren't successful, very successful in being diverse. And I don't think that's a housing thing. I think we did as much or more than other parts of the university. It's just a tough one. And I think I read something
still
where
is.
It's a, still a difficulty, and it will be. Michigan had an easier time with that, in part, again, because it's sort of that kind of place, as I said earlier, hell, let's give it a try.
Yeah, right.
You know,
yeah.
And consistency was not a goal in Michigan. Fair and equal treatment was not a high priority in Michigan. A higher priority there was to be diverse, bring in people who were different. And there were great flaws and problems with that. When I was hired at Michigan, 4 people who were black were hired at the same time, 3 of whom became alcoholics by the time I left. And that was because, in part, I can't say of all the reasons, but I do know some of them, and they came with far less qualification, and I think were not honestly dealt with, things like that. So I don't want to say that I know the way, the right way to do these things, but I do know, I have an opinion about different cultures and how they deal with that kind of thing. Eagle Heights experience is wonderful in its diversity. And I think what people gained from that experience out there, where I think it's 60-some percent of the residents are from other countries, is without programming, without doing something conscious, enforcing it, people learn about people who are different than themselves, and that is that value that I thought was so important about housing anyway, way back when I started in this. I think it still is. If someone from a Middle Eastern country meets somebody from Europe, they talk, they listen, they hear one another, what matters to them, what's going on in the world, they're both better for it at the end. It would be wonderful to have more diversity here, be it race, different countries and so on, in residence halls and so on, but it's a tough one in Wisconsin. It's easier in places that have a larger urban population that include those diverse races and all. I think the world's going to have more of that anyway, with us having more people from all over the world living in any of our urban communities. So even if we don't work hard at it, I think it's going to happen. But Wisconsin's a little slower on it just because it has this history of being a kind of a rural area.
Well, Eagle Heights is really quite the exception. I lived out there for 4 years, and we had Indian neighbors, we had African neighbors, we had neighbors from European neighbors. It was just
different
a melting
foods.
Pot. Yeah. Oh, yeah. You'd come home at night, and it's this Indian couple, the woman was quite a cook, and you'd come in at night, and you'd smell this great food, and you want to go upstairs and have dinner. And
stuff. Yeah. No, it's a wonderful place.
Let's move to some of the issues that you faced as director of housing. You oversaw the unit as you said in your note to me, as it moved from electric typewriters to Wangs to personal computers. This was an incredible time in the history of the world. I mean, we are going to be looking at this for a long, long time. Talk a little bit about the introduction of computers to the division. You had 2 different things going on. You had the local area computer network, which was for housing itself, and then you had the residence halls and the wiring of the residence halls and what are they called, ARCHES, the academic resource and computers and housing centers. Why don't you start where you want on that and talk about
the introduction to that.
The important thing to say at the start of anything, and probably regularly throughout all of this, is it's probably the case in most places, but it certainly is true with me, is much of what occurred, the changes we made, the things that were successful, creative, new, were either an individual who worked with me or the group of us. It wasn't me, the director. I don't think in my administration the director did things. Hopefully we had an organization that facilitated bringing in new ideas at the right time and finding a way to implement them. But I would say that it was at least the Bob Fessendens, the Paul Evans, the Alice Gustafsons, Kay Reuter Crohn's, and the staffs that worked with them that came up with ideas that we facilitated getting to work. Mm-hmm. And so never do I want it to appear that it was Norm Sunstead that did something. It was during that era in which I was the director of the choir or something, but yeah. You know, I didn't make the instruments play. And if I did it right, the right things were able to occur, and that I didn't get in the way of too many of them.
And that's an important part of administration too, sometimes, is staying out of the way. Yeah,
it is. I think so. There are very different styles about how people do that, and I think stating what my goal was in terms of that. There are kind of a couple of different things on the computer thing. One of them was kind of administration, and that was typewriters and sort of weighings when I arrived, there being computers on every desk and so on. And I think a lot of that credit goes to Joanne Ullman, who was an assistant to Larry Halley, and an assistant to Newell, I think. And it started out as a secretary to Newell, I think, but a brilliant person who saw the vision in terms of computers and where that was going. And there were many times, and she'd love to hear this, I'm sure, she's since retired, that she would come up with something that she told me was going to be the next step, and here's what we ought to do, and I'd say, you're nuts, we're not going to do that, and we didn't. And it would take some years before we'd eventually do it, and I'd reflect back, and she was damn well absolutely right. One of the things that I remember so specifically Joanne saying is, we should eliminate the secretarial thing. You each should have a computer on your own desk and do your own notes and do the whole works. Now, you got to be nuts. That's never going to happen. Well, of course, that is what happens now. And that's true throughout the world. And she said this, 10 to 12 years ago. Anyway, she moved us with other people into bringing on computers, getting rid of the wings, but also the data systems office, ADP, I think it's called, worked with us on that too. We were part of the university, we'd look over our shoulders and see what other people were doing, and then we'd move in that direction too. One of the things about it, Barry, is when you're a part of that time, you don't think of anything dramatic really that's going on. You're doing these things progressively as they make sense. And I don't think of some dramatic moment when mm-hmm. we said, aha, by God, now we're going to do it this way. I remember an enlightenment that I had, and probably somebody else gave it to me, but I remember the sense that the computer is the paper and pencil of the years before. And I know this was one moment, and I thought, that's true. That's exactly what that is. This is a tool. Early on, there were all these controls in purchasing throughout the university and even in our administration on, boy, we're not going to let anybody buy one of these damn computers because it's going to cost a lot and it's just a toy and blah, blah, blah. And then at some point, we just kind of switched over and realized that as we can afford them, the sooner we get these things, the better off we are, because it really is the paper and pencil. Mm-hmm. It is it's a tool of doing administration. It's not an end in itself. It's not a toy. And then I think we really moved forward all at once. I don't remember when that was, but I do know it was an enlightenment I had, and I'm sure others had it properly before me. And they're still doing it. I suspect they're getting close to done, but eventually there'll be a computer and every staff member will have. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I moved to Western State College, and we're at the same stage there. There's a computer on every desk, and I suspect we were just at Wisconsin listening to other people and moving along at the same pace.
Yeah.
In the And then the other area of computerization was for our customers, for the students, for the residents. And there's one little funny story on that, is one day, back when Bill Sweet was still alive, this woman from Apple came to see me, and I remember her so vividly because she had, I believe it's even a hat, but hat, suit, and shoes that all matched, and it seems to me they were bright yellow. She was sales, but she was a spiffy dresser. And she offered, I think it was 50 Apple computers for free. Some number of them anyway. And of course we're all looking at ourselves thinking, free, this is a good deal, we're gonna do this. By the end of the first year, I think it cost us $55,000. What we learned is tables, paper, there were a million things that go along with, and it was back to there's no such thing as a free lunch.
Yeah, right.
At any rate, we got those apples, we started out that. Bill Sweet was really tickled with this, and in his last year worked on, as best he could, trying to implement some of these things. And of course, as I said earlier, he was in charge of student affairs, and the in many ways started the ARCHES, these academic resources and computers and housing. We changed the name over time on that. Originally, they were converted dining rooms that were study rooms and kind of academic support rooms. And then we had these spaces, the need for computers, computer access on the part of students grew. The rest of the university libraries and so on didn't have the resources to do all of that. We knew it was what students wanted, what residence hall students needed. And we could provide them, we had the space, we had the equipment, we put the money into it, and it was very successful. Knowing full well that at some point, and I don't know where that is now, that we very well may be moving away from these ARCHES because every student will have their own computer and do their own stuff in the room. I don't know if it's changed, but though we did find out in recent times that the social part of these rooms was terribly important, and we're not sure, we weren't sure, whether we'd ever get rid of those rooms because people like to be among other living, breathing things when they work on a computer. And so they've grown in number and size, and then of course the wiring, the residence halls, the rooms for voice, video, and data came up. I attribute an awful lot of that to Paul Evans. Paul saw, he was running Physical Plant at the time, the specification design and so on to see that we got the wiring done the way we should. And all of us, I'm sure, were a part of deciding this was the thing to do. We're always trying to figure out what it is in housing you needed to do next to be current for what students' needs were at the university. And I think housing was ahead of the university in many ways in terms of thinking about that and bringing that stuff online. I think the university is real pleased that we did it. And we had good support from people like Torfi along the way. It cost us $5 million, I believe it was, to rewire all of the buildings for voice, video, and data. We needed to do it for voice anyway in some of the buildings where, you know, Tripp and Adams were built before there were phones in them, and so those phone lines were stapled up against the wall. And so we needed to do that. Video was more and more important to students, and then the data thing as well. It was a natural, when you think about it, $5 million isn't much. And so that was completed some few years ago.
How was that? How did the $5 million?
We borrowed money for it. We had our debt down pretty low. Things I'll tell you now, don't tell the administration even though it's on tape. Newell felt, and he was right, as always, that you need to have enough debt that nobody can come in and raid auxiliaries for their money. And Newell ran the place in a very frugal way. There wasn't extra money laying around. But Newell had a bit of debt that carried over from building the Southeast dorms. We were fortunate through my time to pay off, I think they're all paid off now, we were down to almost no debt. That's not a good position to be in. Now and then the state would look at auxiliaries, and they did actually take some money from some others. They've never taken any money from Wisconsin, Madison, because we've always managed in a way to be frugal, but also not have any reserves sitting around that somebody could raid. And so we needed some debt. We didn't go out consciously create debt just to create debt, but it it fit very well with this project. And I know Paul has got some other debt going too.
We did some borrowing on Eagle Heights remodeling, and I think a few other things we've done too. I think he's probably doing some of that to put in the fire sprinkler systems in the dorms too. We were starting that when I left, but that's another good project he's working on. At any rate, the computer stuff, we lament that it costs so much. The staff in housing that works just in support of the computer systems is at least as large as the staff at Western State College in terms of their do-it operation. But it is today, it's what students want and need. One of the things that drove Newell and his administration, and I think drove ours and continues to, is what do students in residence halls need and want, and how can we provide it? We need to listen to our customer and do what is best for them. And usually, almost always, they know. As Newell would say, if you can't convince the students that what you're doing is right and what is what should be done, it probably shouldn't be done that way. And he's right about that. During the mid-60s to late-60s, early 70s, I think almost every housing operation, large housing operation in the nation, was run by the business side of things, the business manager of a college or university, not student affairs side of it. And almost all of those people that I know of either were forced to retire or were fired. But that was not true at Wisconsin. And the reason is, it is my feeling, that Newell had always run the place, and the history of housing back with the earlier guys was that we're running this, what we're doing is what the students want. We need to listen to them and do what they want. We're not administrators, and students should conform to what administrators want. And other places, it was run in that way. Michigan turned over its staff, Indiana, Ohio, all of those places. Not at Wisconsin. And the reason was that way, way back, the commitment of the university and the directors of housing was, we work for the students. And I think that's a great credit to Wisconsin, wherever that started, probably with Don Halverson way back. And we stay with that, and I'm sure they stay with that today as a driving force. It is more the style of the way housing operations are run nationally than it was way, way back. So Newell and his crew were inventive, I think, and unique back in their time. And that's less true as others catch up with us, I suppose you'd say, along the way. So that's the computer thing, I think, as I think of it anyway.
Okay, you mentioned Eagle Heights just a couple of moments ago. During the 40s, 50s, and 60s, there was a lot of building going on in dorms. You had the Southeast dorms, you had the Lakeshore dorms, a lot of stuff going on. When was Chadman rebuilt? That was a while back, I guess.
Yeah, that was probably early 60s, 50s, yeah. Something.
Anyway,
like, yeah.
the main structures were built. As a matter of fact, some of the dorms were converted into office space. Was that? After the 60s, probably.
Real drop-off, in the Bob Dylan era, when everybody was supposed to go live in a dump off campus.
And then later on, as soon as they converted them to offices, everybody decided they wanted to live in dorms again, and you had more problems.
That was probably when Newell felt that the timing didn't work right. But he needed those buildings, it's just that he didn't need them right when he had them.
Yeah, and so Goodnight and a couple of others were converted into office space. But during your administration, you had to do a lot of remodeling and a lot of renovating of those buildings because, as you said, times change, needs change, et cetera, et cetera. One of the big renovation projects that you undertook was Eagle Heights. Could you talk a little bit about, I think it was Bob Fessenden who told me that this was your initiative.
I would say it would have been Bob's.
Well, there you go.
Bob was in charge of facilities at the time, and Bob, the great thing about Bob is he would push you on stuff that he thought needed to be done, and he was right. Eagle Heights, this is important to know, and Newell would say this too. The plan for Eagle Heights was to build these buildings as inexpensively as possible, to not fund them with any reserve, and expect them when they live their useful life as bulldozing.
No, really.
This was a conscious decision, and Newell even had these discussions with the regents, which is really important.
Really? I didn't know that.
And so the rents were cheap. Oh, they were cheap.
I
and these buildings
that,
were
yeah.
falling down around our knees. They were, walls were buckling out, kitchen units we couldn't get parts for, water was leaking, And Bob's trying to keep this damn place together.
Well, Bob also said that the needs have changed. We had these little cubicle ice boxes,
yep,
almost, and he said people were starting to move big refrigerators,
yep,
in because they needed more room for food storage.
And Bob was beaten on us, I mean, in a right way, in a good way. So we got to remodel these places. And we were struggling with trying to figure out how to do it. And through Bob and Ray Werspinski and others of us, Paul at the time, I think, Paul Evans was working for as an assistant to Bob, I think. We had a while, we had an assistant to the director job that I was just trying to provide help to Bob with. And we came up with a plan, and here my own thinking on this, I've not had this confirmed, but worked for Len, and I don't think Len wanted to do this project, Len Van Ness. And I don't think he thought we'd ever get it passed through the trustees. But we put together a plan and financed it in large part with increased rents. And we really jacked up the rents, and we took a hell of a beating. I mean,
I remember reading about that. People were mad.
This was a tough deal. And we got it going. And we underestimated a couple things, I think reasonably. But we didn't estimate quite right the amount of revenue loss we'd have through the turnover. It was tough to move people out, redo a building, move people back in, and all of that. And that turned out to be an estimate error we made. I think the cost per apartment grew faster than we thought. There were a couple things that we missed on, and so we got beat up one time by the trustees about that. But all told, I think that project's going to be finished in about 2 more years, I think. 14-year project. I think by the time it's done, it's going to be a hell of a lot more than we estimated, but probably proper in terms of inflation. But Bob really pushed on that, and we heard his argument. The trustees, or the regents, every school I go to, they call them something different, but supported it. I think Len was surprised. I think Shane was surprised. It's the right thing to do, and when this project is done, we now have the rent base up high enough to where these things should be maintained forever and forever.
Mm-hmm.
And so this, much to Bob's credit, the whole thing, I think now is set up, the family housing thing is set up to operate well far into the future. And so that's something from my era that I'm proud of, much to the credit of Bob and Paul and all of us. Ray worked on it too. The financing of it was tricky. Because we weren't charging anything, we had to create a reserve and then also create money to do the construction. We funded some out of borrowing too, not a lot, is how we're doing it. And the family housing residents fought us on it, in part because these people are living.
The residents fought it because they're living on very little.
They're living on very little. They're trying to get by. They've got families. And then they also, I've never met anybody whose rent was too cheap. Everybody, you know, even what they're paying, no matter what they're paying, it should be less. And when you double it or whatever we did, it was a lot. But we got the thing going now, and once you get the momentum going and people see these apartments that are remodeled, they want to move to them. Initially, we had struggles with that. There's a lot more detail to that that I could give you or Paul could. But it's a good project. I'm glad we're doing it. It's a great asset to the university. And the other piece of that that at some point I want to talk about is the community services kind of function we have going on out there that we developed as well.
Let's talk about that right now.
Okay. And I think that would be somewhat Bob Bessenden, who started out working with that in my time, and then Paul working on it a lot too. We hired a director of family housing with a slightly different bent. The old style, and it was part of, we got to get back to this, the Newell's philosophy, and appropriate for the time, was low cost at all costs.
Mm-hmm.
The goal is to have housing cost as little as possible because the kids at the university are broke, need everything they can to get through school, every bit of support. Housing should be as cheap as it can be. And what changed in my time was a desire on the part of students to have services. Low cost at all costs is no longer a priority. At least, these are oversimplifications.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Of course, there are people who are very, very poor. But
students really want to have services, and they're raised in homes that are more and more well off, or at least comfortable. They are second, third generation college students. They're not the kid off the farm, at least with the frequency they used to be. And so we had to provide computers in residence halls, amenities, services, better food service, nicer dining rooms. And that change, I think, was probably the most dramatic cultural change from Newell's time to my time. And in family housing, they expected more too. They don't want to pay more for it. Mm-hmm. And frankly, in terms of community services in family housing, what I mean by that is, let me put it this way, in residence halls over the years from the 50s, 60s, 70s, there's been a development of a student development philosophy in residence halls, how students can grow and develop in residence halls. An educational experience outside of the classroom, mm-hmm. getting to know people who are different, learning how to resolve matters of dispute, studying different things, getting involved in student government, that kind of thing. Family housing, nowhere in the nation do I know of, has had that kind of philosophy and needed some kind of educational philosophy to support their living there. And over time, with Laura Shearer in charge of family housing, with Paul, we put more money into community services, which is sort of realizing we have a city out there, and there need to be city services, support for kids, a network of communication, computer support, support for families who are struggling while one of them or two of them are in school, and there are cultural differences, counseling systems, that kind of thing. And so that's been being developed, and I think it's been really exciting for those people because they aren't building on some philosophy that existed back in the 50s, they're creating it. So they're trying things to see how they work, try something else if that doesn't work. And so they've got a fun job out there. But that's a new thing since Newell's time, too. Newell's time, it was no service or basic services, minimal service, save costs, save money, keep the cost as low as possible, to a philosophy now of how can we support students. There will be some cost with it, but how can we make their lives for their families, mm-hmm. for them better while they're students?
I think we're coming to the time where we have to stop today, but I think tomorrow we might want to pick up and look at the child care issue, uh-huh. and look at some issues like domestic partners, because mm-hmm. we're getting societal changes, we're getting, yeah. Families are, the whole concept of what a family is changing,
yeah.
And you guys are sort of right, yeah. in the center of that, which is one of the reasons I'm so fascinated, yeah. about housing, because that's where all of these things are first become evident.
Yeah.
So I think we're about set for today, and why don't we pick this up tomorrow?
Why don't I say one other thing? Sure. I know that you had studied housing before with Newell's time and so on, and were fascinated, somebody told me, about the history and how it operates as a family and all. I want to say that is true. The bias I have, of course, is I hope that's true, and I was the director far distant from the slug who's out there cleaning rooms and so on, although I used to do that on some regular basis just to stay in touch. But I do think that is unique about housing here or this organization, and it doesn't have to be housing. I think it's people like Newell, how you manage so that you try to keep a family orientation of inclusion. I think that is a great attribute, and I hope it still exists. I know there are cultural pulls and pushes on that kind of thing. We used to feel frustrated periodically with new civil service rules or system rules or state rules that were taking away from us the ability to support, maintain our family nature. Mm-hmm. And I think that's still a frustration and a difficulty. I understand, again, governments try to be fair, consistent, the same, and when you implement these same things, you take away individuality and unique ways of operating in various departments, and that's too bad. But it is part of that Northern European culture, and it's a struggle. But I hope it still exists, and as I would say, my goal, by the time I walk out the door, or walked out of the door, and I don't know if it's the case or not, would be to try to not lose what the previous administrations had done. And were I able to be a part of improving any of this beyond what they'd done, that would be just frosting on the cake, because it was a great place when I came, and I would be entirely satisfied leaving saying, we didn't do much damage.
Yeah. Well, the other thing I've noticed about the people I've worked with in housing, and I say this is in a very complimentary way, you don't stumble over people's egos. Or that is just not as evident as it is in a lot of other units, perhaps even here on campus.
Not even perhaps.
I'm trying to be diplomatic here, Norm. So,
yeah.
I really noticed that, especially with my first association with people, again, like Larry.
Yeah, Larry is
who's less ego involved and a more humble person
and
than Larry Galley.
Gabe. George Gerda, another one.
George is certainly another one. Yeah.
And I actually think Newell, too. I think Newell, his directorness was the way you had to be as a director, but I never felt anything was for Newell's ego.
Oh, I never.
It was
entirely
for the good of housing. It was. It's just the military style of things.
Yeah.
Okay. Today.